this morning. But I wanted to set the stage with a few questions as we move into the message. Have you ever felt at one point or another in your life that you were disqualified? Disqualified for something that you couldn't control. You know, maybe it had to do with your background, or maybe it had to do with your upbringing. Maybe it had to do with a weakness or even a perceived weakness that was never true or wasn't true anymore, but because of that reputation, because of the label that you had, people in your life disqualified you from whatever. As I thought back kind of through my life, I feel like there's been a lot of times I've kind of been thrust into leadership situations. And sometimes I wasn't ready. Most of the time, I wasn't ready. And sometimes I was, but there was just a misunderstanding. Probably the clearest one for me was shortly after we moved back here, I began working part-time as an installer for a garage door company in Syracuse. I had been doing garage doors for like 10 or 12 years at that time. I really knew the ins and outs of them. And so I just began a part-time installation, being an installer and technician. But very quickly, they'd seen my resume, and I'd been in the office before, and they were looking for like a full-time office manager position. And after just a few months of being there, they promoted me to this position. But there was a problem, because I was a 24-year-old kid that had been there for like 4 or 5 months, and there were people that had been there a long, long time on the road. There were guys that had been in the business for 30 or 35 years that were 30 years to my senior that were still installing doors in February, and here they have a kid after just a few months moved into the office, and now I'm telling them what their schedule looks like, and I'm telling them when they can and can't go home, and I'm telling them when they can have vacation and when they can. And it was an uphill struggle at first, because they didn't know me. I hadn't been there that long, and they didn't know that I knew what I was doing. And it was tough. But we got there, and I'm glad to say that it ironed out very fast, and they learned to trust me, and they learned to have they learned what the benefit was to have somebody that had installed and had been a technician in the office, because I was a little bit better at scheduling, because I actually knew what it took to get these jobs done. And so we ended up having a good relationship. Or maybe you've been on the other side of this. If we're honest, we could probably, each and every one of us, think of a time when we were disqualified for something that we couldn't control, and that when we disqualified someone else for something that they couldn't control, or because that there was a perceived weakness that we thought that they had, and so we disqualified them and we became bitter. Maybe there was a point in time when you were at a job and somebody was promoted and elevated above you, and you knew what they were like outside of work, and it tainted the view that you had of them, and you had this concept that the people at work, they didn't know who that really was, or they never would have put them in charge of all of this. Or I'm better at my job and I work harder. How is it that they're put in authority over me? It happens time and time again. And we're going to dig through 1 Timothy 4:12. Let no one despise you for your youth, but set an example to the believers. But we're going to spend a lot of time developing the context, and not the context of the passage, because this is a verse that has been used a lot. 4:12 is saturated youth ministries. There are ministries named 4:12. There are conventions named 4:12. There are youth groups and books and curriculums called 4:12. But without understanding who the verse was written to in this letter from Paul to Timothy, without understanding who Timothy was, without understanding the climate of his ministry, he was placed at too young of an age into Ephesus, one of the most horrific cities that has ever existed. And we're going to walk through that this morning and put into context this encouragement that Paul had to let no man despise him for his youth. And starting with Ephesus, it's important to get a picture of just the scale of the city that was Ephesus. Ephesus was located in the Asia province. It was the imperial capital of that province. It was the fourth largest city in the known world. The population of Ephesus at this point in history was 250,000. 250,000 people, that's like roughly twice the size of Syracuse, of like greater Syracuse. This was a huge number of people, especially for this point in history. Their primary industry as a city was slavery. And to give you an idea of just how immense their market share was, just how immense it was as an industry, the Greco-Roman Empire at this time had more slaves than free men. History agrees that the Greco-Roman Empire at this time had more slaves than free men. So if you were walking down the street, one out of every two people you walked past was a slave. So you got that? The vast, ridiculous number that can probably not even be calculated what that means, okay? One out of every two slaves came from Ephesus. More slaves than free men in the whole empire, and half of them came out of the city of Ephesus. And you should be asking yourself, how is that even possible? Because we know how slaves were made. For the most part, they were made by conquering other nations. So the Romans would take a legion of soldiers and they would conquer a town, and many or all of the people in that town would be put into the slavery market, and that's how slaves existed. Or if you owned a mommy and a daddy slave and they had a baby that was born into slavery, and that was another way that slaves were made. So it's interesting that a city could have that immense of a slave industry. Because it was literally reproducing, creating slaves. And the reason that it was creating slaves at such an exorbitant rate is because of the horrific, lust-centered, completely horrible reputation and practices that it had. The chief glory in Ephesus was the Artemis Temple. Some of you should, at least by name, recognize the Artemis Temple. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. Artemis was the goddess of fertility. They were the temple wardens of Artemis, so this was her city. So they considered themselves owned, body, mind, and soul, by the goddess of fertility. You don't have to think for very long as to what it might look like to worship a goddess of fertility, but it was horrible, disgusting acts. The temple of Artemis was the crown jewel of the city. It was four times the size of the Parthenon in Athens. Like, we all know the Parthenon. You've seen pictures of it. This was four times as big. The temple of Artemis was 425 feet long, 225 feet wide. It was a football field and a half long. And almost a football field as long it was wide. It was a huge, ridiculous, marble, beautiful structure. And because it was the crown jewel of the city, it was the center of everything. It was the center of commerce. It was the center of social activity and politics. It was a city of refuge. If you were wanted in any region for any reason, if you would be willing to announce whatever religion you had and accept the religion of Artemis, they would protect you in that temple. It had running water and beautiful gardens. But unfortunately, it was a huge society built on lust-centered ideologies and lust-centered theologies, and so they churned out children. But unfortunately, the social structure and the economic structure of that time was a class system, which meant whatever you had, your sum total net worth, was divided amongst the total number of people in your family. And if it equaled enough, you were let into these different tiers of the social class. So you could be sitting pretty, and you just made it into this first class, and you have just enough money to kind of cover all the people in your family, and you get pregnant, and you have a baby, you're knocked out of that class. So in a society that was churning out babies at a rate probably never matched ever, they were also demanding and structuring their whole society that the fewer children you had, the higher you could live. And so these babies were discarded and they were given up as slaves. And you had a gigantic metropolis, what was considered the first and greatest metropolis of the world, churning out slaves. Worship of Artemis was horrific. All of the worst things that you have heard and read about Sodom and Gomorrah, the absolute worst parts of Las Vegas would look like the Mickey Mouse buffet compared to what was in this. I could spend four services going over the horrible culture that was Ephesus. It was a dark and dangerous, and it was a vile place. two great festivals of the year that commemorated her as the deity. They would take her down. The biggest was in the spring, a time of rebirth and rejuvenation, and they would take her down out of the temple, and they would march her through the streets of Ephesus. And people would cut themselves and open themselves up and cut things off and smear the statue with blood to show their dedication and their devotion to this false god, to this pagan god. And so when that statue got to the side of the river, dipping in blood, they would take it into the water and they would cleanse it. And it would signify the rejuvenation of her as their deity. And then the entire city, millions of people that would have come in for this festival, would then break out in the most debaucherous, horrifying, horrible acts. We find out a little bit about Ephesus in Acts 19. Paul, on his first missionary journey, makes a stop in Ephesus. He stays there. It's one of the longest stays he's ever made. We know that he started initially preaching in the synagogue. For one reason or another, it doesn't tell us, he moves out of the synagogue into a neutral place. It was the Hall of Tyrannus. We don't know a whole lot about that. We don't even know why it's called the Hall of Tyrannus, whether it was a man that owned it, but it was a great lecture hall. So whether it was owned by a man named Tyrannus, or perhaps there was a great scholar or lecturer of that day named Tyrannus, and so it was named that to kind of commemorate him. But Paul met, and it was a neutral place, so both Jews and Greeks could meet there to hear about the gospel of Christ. And Paul tells in his account in Acts 19 that they would labor in the early, early hours of the morning, living as homeless people. They didn't have homes, and they had no food. They're living as outsiders in this culture, so they would work manually for the first few hours of the day to get just enough sustenance to keep on going. He says that they lived homelessly and in rags and in destitution. And then in 3 hours, in the heat of the day, in the Hall of Tyrannus, for 2 years, he preached the gospel to the city of Ephesus. Highs during the summertime in Ephesus during the day is 120 degrees. 120 degrees, he stood in the Hall of Tyrannus 3 hours every single day, sharing about the blood of Christ and how it cleanses. The most I've ever preached in a row was 2 Sundays. And I almost died. I don't know how pastors do it. I'm sure it comes with experience and practice. But it takes an incredible amount of preparation time for me. It takes an incredible amount of just mental energy. And it's exhausting. And I've mountain biked huge distances and not felt as tired as I would, as I do at the end of a Sunday that I preached. So to think about Paul preaching 3 hours every day for 2 years is inconceivable. But it had effect. It had absolutely unbelievable effect. A huge revival broke out in Ephesus. Kind of at the peak of that, we find out that the sorcerers and soothsayers that had come out of the occult of that worship, there was an incredible amount of like dark magic stuff surrounding that occult that was the worship of Artemis, as you can imagine. So these sorcerers pulled all of their scrolls and all of their occult documents together. They would have contained seances, and they would have contained rituals, and they would have contained spells and all of the kind of tools of the trade of the sorcerers, and they put them in a public location in the middle of the city, and they burned them for all to see, to show their devotion to the one true God, to show their devotion to Christ. And it says at the end of that that this whole guild put a number to the value of the scrolls. It was 50,000 drachma. And if you remember, the value of one drachma is 1 day's labor for a common laborer. So this was 50,000 days worth of work is what it would have taken. I did the math. It's 149 years worth of income. This was an incredible, incredible fortune that they burned in the streets to show their dedication to the one true God. Maybe I should have done the math, but in their head, 25, 30,000 maybe annual income of a common like blue-collar laborer in our society. So whatever that is, times 140, it is a huge, huge fortune. But the reaction wasn't all good. Later on in chapter 9, it talks about Demetrius, who was the head of the Silver Guild, and you can imagine that in a cult like that, in a city that big that was given over that much to a deity, there was a lot of money to be made. There was an incredible amount of money to be made. And so these silversmiths that made the statues, the little idols of Artemis, had a very reliable source of income. and the people that would do that would sell the meat that was offered to her as a deity, as a false god, those meats would have been sold and consumed. And all of a sudden, none of that's happening anymore because the city is turning upside down and people are getting converted left and right. All of a sudden, it starts affecting their pocketbooks. And we find out that Demetrius calls together a bunch of the silversmiths in Ephesus and he gets them all into a great big amphitheater and they begin calling out the name of Artemis and declaring her name to come and to stop. They actually grab two of Paul's disciples and drag them in with them and they start questioning them and trying to find any reason to kill them. They're interviewing them, they're grilling them, they're trying to find any reason to find fault so that they can purge this way that has come and has changed their style of life. Some point in time, Paul actually shows up and he's trying to get into this theater. It's crazy. He's trying to get into this theater, and his disciples are pulling him back. You can just get this picture of them, like this big mob of raggedy, dirty guys trying to keep Paul out of the theater. And he said, don't you understand? You can't go in there. This is about you. They're angry about you. This is your fault. You can't go in there. They're going to kill you. They will rip you apart if you go in there. They've got two of our apostles already. We don't know what's happening. We don't know what they're going to do with them. You can't go in there. Find out that Paul hangs out for a couple more days in Ephesus until things die down, and then he hands off the ministry to his disciples, and he moves on with the rest of his missionary journey. He moved on to Macedonia after that. But Paul had started a church where a massive revival broke out, and hundreds of converts were happening every single day in the greatest city, in the fourth largest city of the known world, and he had a decision to make because now somebody had to be in charge of all of that. He had to set somebody over all of that and shepherd what had just happened and control the madness of the conversions that were happening every single day. And in our humanness, you immediately turn to like a list of qualifications, right, that you would have. Because here is somebody that's going to have the most horrific, bloody, dark, terrible city possibly that has ever existed as their mission field. So you're going to need somebody that's like really like mentally tough. There's a really strong, mentally strong person to overcome everything that's happening and everything that's going to happen within the church of Ephesus. And he's going to be placed over a large number of presbyters. Because remember, I always kind of pictured in my head Ephesus as like a little town somewhere with a little white church with a steeple. And Tim as like a 19 or 20-year-old pastor standing up front shepherding the flock. That's not the case at all. This was an apostolic head position. So he would have been in charge of all of the churches in the city, of the presbyters and the religious heads, of all of the churches, of all of the home churches in the city and in the region. So anything within that general region, anybody that would have shopped at Ephesus for their groceries and went to church, Paul was in charge of them. So this person would have been in charge of them, the person that Paul had to find. So incredibly mentally tough. You'd want somebody that was just like completely 100% above reproach, had like the best background, the easiest person to just follow because revival is breaking out. And the last thing you want is to have like more things for this person to overcome. So spotless heritage, spotless background, somebody out of a really good family. Somebody's really mentally tough and spiritually tough. And then you'd want that person to certainly be of age. They need to be of a certain age where those underneath them would respect them and would make that office easy and to make the transition easy because this fledgling church needs a leader. But that's not what happened. It's not who he chose at all. True to form, Paul decides to place Timothy at the head of the church of Ephesus. Timothy had on paper almost none of the qualifications that you would expect to see for a person of that stature, to have a person of that office. One of the very first things that we find out about Timothy is his blood status. We're told right away that his mother, Eunice, was a Jew, and his grandmother was a Jew. And they had a great rapport with Paul, and Paul respected them, those two women, very, very much. And we're told in both letters to Timothy how much Paul respected his mother and his grandmother. But we're also told that his father was a Gentile Greek. His father was a Greek pagan. Deuteronomy 23:3, Zechariah 6:9, both long lists of all the ramifications that would apply to Timothy because he was a half-blood. The marriage between a pagan and a Jew was not recognized. The marriage between a Jew and anybody else of any other religion or culture was not recognized. So Timothy was an illegitimate child. Because if the marriage is not recognized, then the child is not recognized as a legitimate child. And there are long, long lists of things that would apply to Timothy. They had a special word for it. The word was mamzer. It's M-A-M-Z-E-R. And it referred to somebody of mixed blood. It referred to a half-blood. And the repercussions were all generational repercussions. It was to be a 400-year curse. So for 10 generations, these would have applied to all of their children and their children's children and their children's children's children all the way out. For 10 generations, his children and himself, they would never have been allowed in the temple. He would not have been allowed to partake or be involved in any kind of Jewish custom whatsoever. In essence, they were considered Gentiles. They wouldn't accept a half-blood because he was half not Jewish, and so he couldn't partake in anything that they had to do. They would have viewed him the same as like the child of a prostitute. So he would have been denied circumcision. He would have been denied access to the temple. He would have been denied any kind of formal Jewish education. It's all right. Deuteronomy 23:3, it gives a long list of what would not have been allowed, what Timothy would not have been allowed to have access to. Which is strange, and it begs the question how he got as educated as he was. Because we know that he was. We know that when Paul met him, he's very taken by Timothy. He's taken by how much he knows about the scriptures. So how would he have gained such an incredible education to the point where Paul deems him qualified for ordination? The highest calling of that time for a young man was to be ordained and to be put over a church. And Paul considered him qualified for ordination and personally saw to his ordination. Certainly he would have learned a lot from Lois and from Eunice, his mother and his grandmother, but their education would have been limited. As women in that culture, they weren't granted the same education that would have gotten them all the way to ordination status. We do know that it happened occasionally. It's almost the only other option that there is, the only other explanation, is those that were cut out of the temple that had a deep passion for the things of God would sit underneath the window or sit outside the door of the temple and listen to the rabbis. Day after day after day, we have a picture of Timothy sitting underneath the temple window, soaking in the teachings of the rabbis. And soaking in the formal education of others, not able to participate or ask questions, not really even supposed to being there, but soaking in the information because the things of God were so important to him that he was compelled to learn everything that he could learn. So right off the bat, we have a blood status issue with Timothy. We have something that for his entire life, people would have been telling him he was not good enough. He was not qualified. He was not included. This wouldn't have been a big deal if he was raised by his father. But he wasn't. He's raised in a Jewish community as an outcast Gentile son of an illegitimate marriage. It would have been a really, really rough upbringing. He would have been immersed daily in things he could not participate in. What a sad childhood. What a hard, hard lesson when everything that you've ever done, when everybody you've ever came in contact deemed you unqualified. So in the most horrific city on the planet, Paul appoints somebody that's got something else to deal with as well. So not only does Timothy have to overcome this city, but now I got to overcome this whole past that he's dealing with. We know that Paul personally sought his circumcision as well. He was so taken by this young man of God that Paul personally sought his ordination. Paul personally sought to his circumcision. We find out that Timothy was saved in Lystra during Paul's first missionary journey. Timothy was a son in the faith to Paul. In fact, Paul considered Timothy and Titus, his adopted sons. We know that in the second missionary journey, Timothy actually accompanies Paul on the second missionary journey. And where this passage picks up in 1 Timothy, when this letter is written to Timothy, and remember, this letter is written to Timothy, Paul wrote this letter to Timothy to encourage him and to walk him through the things that you have to do and to walk him through the things that he had to overcome. And 15 years had passed. So at the point in time of the second missionary journey, we know that Timothy was 22 to 27 years old. 15 years approximately has passed at the time that the letter is written. So we know that Timothy was 35 to 39 years old. So at 35 to 39 years old, we find Timothy in a post in the most horrific city in the world, and he is over all of the churches, and he has been told his entire life that he is disqualified. And almost immediately, we get more bad news. Because in verse 12, it says, "Let no one despise you for your youth." Interestingly enough, I think the connotation in my mind has always been that he was like 20 years old or something like that, like really kind of young. 35 to 39 doesn't seem like it's all that young. Interestingly enough, Hebrew culture, the word that was used, the word that was used here was neoterkos, and it included the first stage of life for the Hebrews. And the first stage of life was 0 to 40. It was a gigantic chronological range. But they also believed that 30 to 40, Irenaeus tells us that in that culture, 30 to 40 was like the best years of development in your life. Which I gotta tell you, I turned 30 like 3 weeks ago, and I thought the world had ended. That's a big number. When I can like start saying things I remember 25 years ago, whoo! So reading this did me a lot of good. I'm like 30 to 40. I just got there. That is awesome. 10 years are the best years of my life. So I'm a Hebrew. Okay. So Irenaeus said that development peaks in 30 to 40 years. So we find out that he could not have been 40. That's why it's 35 to 39, because if this word was used, he would have been less than 40. It's actually the same word that was used in reference to Paul when he was Saul, and it referred to him as like a young, youthful, up-and-coming Pharisee when he oversaw the stoning of Stephen. The same word is used. So it represented the first stage of life, 35 to 39. So it's not that he was really young. And it wasn't that he was young in the faith. We know that he was saved at the first missionary journey. We know that he was 22 to 27 when he went with Paul on the second missionary journey. It's been 15 years since then. So he's had a long walk with Christ. So while it wasn't young, and it wasn't young in the faith, it was young for his office. It was extremely young for his office. Everybody that he would have been placed over, every church head, every church leader, presbyter would have been in the 50 to 80 age range. They would have been 10 to 40 years his senior. Is Paul crazy? Seriously. What's God doing? The most horrific city in the world. And he picks a half-blood that nobody's going to take seriously and doesn't even have like an actual diploma because he's just been sitting under the window eavesdropping on teachers. And now he puts him in a position where everybody's going to look down on him, where everybody's going to tell him not only is he not good enough because of his blood status, but he's not good enough because he's too young. There would have been those that despised him. That's not too strong of a word. It says it right in the text. Let no one despise you for your youth. Paul looked into Timothy and he saw what would be. He saw something in Timothy that Timothy couldn't see in himself and that no one ever had. And he puts him in one of the most stressful, horrifying places in the world. But he did not do so without direction. 1 Timothy 4:12 should be read with some urgency and with some understanding. This wasn't Paul just putting pen to paper telling Timothy some things that he should do that would help in his ministry. Paul is telling Timothy things that he must do or it's not going to work. He's saying, Paul, you don't have age on your side. They're not going to respect you because of your age. And if they don't respect you because of your age, you're going to have to earn every shred of respect that you gain. And he goes on five different areas, five different things that Timothy absolutely must do in order to earn the respect of those that he must lead, to make sure that there was respect given to the gospel, to make sure that there was respect given to his office. This was a huge, huge calling. 1 Timothy 4:12. Let no one despise you for your youth, but set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, and in purity. Set the example. Set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, and in purity. The word here used for speech was a very broad term. You will hear it and you will see it taught that he was specifically talking to Timothy about preaching. That is not right. He is instructing Timothy that every single word that comes out of his mouth is important. That every single word that comes out of his mouth will help him build or help him destroy the credibility and the respect that people have for him and for Christ and for his office. Matthew 12 defines the word that the words that come out of every man and woman's mouth as reflections of our hearts. The words that we say reflect the deep issues within our hearts, and it makes abundantly clear that we will stand accountable for every single word that we have ever said. That is a horrifying, horrifying thought. I have said some horrible things to people that I love, and I've said some really stupid things to everyone else. And to think that I will stand accountable for every word is a scary, scary thing, and it should be, and it should be humbling. And he is telling Paul to keep track of every word that crosses his lips because it matters. In a book from Paul, in the book of Ephesians, a letter written to Ephesus, in chapter 4, verse 29, it says, "Let no corrupt talk come out of your mouths." The Bible is really, really clear. Every word matters. And he's instructing Timothy that it matters more now than ever. Second thing he said was to set an example to the believers in conduct. To set an example to the believers in conduct. He's making it abundantly clear to Timothy that he must be above reproach in his observable life. Everything that he does, everywhere that he goes, is going to be watched, and he must be above reproach. Paul understood that godly life and that godly living adds power and authority to the message of God. Godly life and godly deeds give power and authority to the message. And the opposite? It's hypocrisy. The opposite of your deeds lining up with your words is having your deeds not line up with your words. And it has gotten the church, we have gotten the church, into a horrible, horrible situation, because what the world wants to see is hypocrisy. And unfortunately, it sees it plenty to label us as such. And he is telling Paul, make sure your words line up with your deeds. One of the kind of scariest things about the worship of Artemis and the religion of Ephesus was that it was extremely liberal and kind of nebulous. It was notorious for absorbing the beliefs of other religions. Oh, you believe that? Well, we believe this. We'll believe that, and we'll believe this, and we're okay. So it was very strange to have the way come in that had one true God, and there was one path, and there was one right way. And they weren't going to compromise, and they're not going to just kind of jump in. They can believe that. Just come over here, believe this and that. Everybody's happy. We're good. They would have been looking very hard to see Timothy waver. They would have been looking very hard to see him compromise. And Paul is saying, you must not compromise. Your deeds must line up with your words. Have you ever met anybody that you wish, like genuinely wish, they'd stop telling people that they were a Christian? If we're honest, definitely. If we're honest, we could even say that there's been times when the things that we said or the things that we did, you have that like trigger in your mind, you're like, holy cow, I hope they don't find out I'm a Christian, because that was really mean, or that was really dumb, or I can't believe I did that, or I can't believe I said that. I hope they don't know that I'm a Christian. I hope they don't find out that I am a Christian. I went fishing with a guy a few years ago. We went out on a charter boat, and charter fishing, you have the captain, and then you have like the first mate, and he runs all the lines and everything, and I was going with a group of guys, and one of the guys is somebody that I'd kind of witnessed to, and I'd talked to a lot about the things of God, and had constantly, you know, he'd constantly come back with a hypocrite line, he constantly came back with what he'd seen, he constantly came back with all of those old taglines that we've all heard about how Christians are hypocrites. And so trying to overcome and open these lines of communication, we get on this boat, and the first mate was just the most horrible person, like just horrible mouth and jokes, and he doesn't know who we are, and right off the bat he's just swearing and he's cussing, he's telling jokes you don't, that shouldn't even be told in, like, I don't know, somewhere you don't tell jokes. Anyway, it was really dark, it was really bad, and then halfway through the day he starts talking about Jesus. What am I ever going to say again? But it's pieces of all of us. There are areas in each and every one of our lives where we know this to be true. Do our deeds line up with our words? Thirdly, he says to make sure that you're an example to believers in love. Example to the believers in love. This is not talking about relational, hey buddy, punch you in the arm, love. The word that is used for love here is agape. It is the deepest form of godly love. It is unconditional love. It is sacrificing love. It is selfless love. What he is instructing Timothy is that he must have deep personal connection with the brethren. He needs to have a deep personal love with those that he wishes to minister to and with. And that he needs to have a genuine concern for his neighbors. Genuine concern for those around him that are not yet saved. One thing that Paul demonstrated to us over and over and over and over and over again was his willingness to love dangerously. His willingness to love dangerously. He said in Philippians 2:17, "Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all to do so." He understood that his personal feelings, that his personal health, that the way that he made a living, everything paired to the comparison of God's glory, and he was in it. He understood that the world's definition, the world loves because of feelings. The world that we live in loves because of feelings. What God commanded us to do and what Paul understood and what he's trying to get through to Timothy is that we are to love regardless of our feelings. We are to understand that the love that we have and that we are to reflect was never ours to begin with. That the best parts about us are because of him, and the only thing good about us is that he loved us the most. And so he is encouraging Timothy to love dangerously. Christ said on no uncertain terms that we are to be recognized. We are to be recognized as followers of Christ because of the love that we have for one another. Fourthly, he charged Timothy to be an example in faith. An example in faith. Understand, this is not a belief in God. Obviously, he believed in God. If Paul had to like remind him to believe in God, he probably shouldn't be where he was. This is talking about unswerving commitment. Probably the easiest passage is just like four verses up. In verses 7 through 8, of 1 Timothy 4, 7 through 8, have nothing to do with irreverent, silly myths. Rather, train yourself for godliness. For while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. It puts it in the context of bodily training to try to draw a parallel. As you can imagine, in Ephesus, their physical appearance was very important to them. It was a lust-centered, physically-driven society. Their games and their Olympics and their amphitheaters and their theaters and their sports and all of that was very, very important. And he's using this analogy to say that everything that applies when you apply yourself physically applies infinitely more when you do it spiritually. I don't really have any examples of this. I wasn't a big sports guy. I would play anything, but I was never really super committed to anything. And as I kind of went through what this might look like in my own life, it was easy. It's hunting. A lot of you know that I'm a huge hunter. And if you're going to sit in a tree, the freezing cold, getting frostbite places you should never get frostbite, then you want to maximize your chances for success. And in verses 7 and 8, Paul is telling him to spare no efforts. To spare no efforts in reaching the objective. To discard every handicap and every burden. And to set his eyes upon the goal and keep focused on that spiritual objective that was to bring glory to God and to spread the gospel. In about a month's time, my wife will not want to talk to me at all. Because all I will be able to talk about is the preparations I'm making for deer season. And she gets really annoyed. And I don't blame her. She doesn't want to see the deer that I just got a picture of on my trail cam. She doesn't want to know what I'm doing with the camo. She doesn't want to know where I'm hanging a stand. But true to form, as it happens every year, she will get to the point where she says, okay, you have 3 minutes, and then you're done for the season. And let me tell you, I can get a lot in 3 minutes. But for me, I love it. And I want to maximize my chances for success. And so I don't spare any effort. Whatever it takes physically, whatever it takes to climb up in a tree, whatever it takes, I spare no efforts to get it done. Anything that's going to prevent me from not getting a deer, I lay aside and I discard. I discard every handicap or burden. I soak all my stuff in scented things and hang them outside and go through great, great lengths to make sure everything is prepared just the best that I can. I make sure my gun is sighted in and I make sure the wind is going to be just right and I make sure that my stand is in the right tree and I have shooting lanes. I'll stop, or you'll end up hating me too. And then I set my eyes upon the goal and I focus on that objective. When I'm in the stand, I'm hunting. There's no point doing all of that to climb up in a tree on a freezing day and fall asleep. But how this applies, each and every one of us can relate to something in our lives that we view like this. For most of us, it will be a sport. For some of us, it will be a job. Maybe it will be fishing and hunting for some of you. But Paul is saying it is of infinitely more importance that we do these things in our lives when it comes to ministering to those around us and to loving those around us dangerously and to reaching others for Christ. We are to spare no efforts in getting the gospel out. We are to let go anything in our lives. We are to discard any kind of burden or handicap that would keep us from getting our job done. And we are to fix our eyes on him. So we are constantly reminded of our objective and of our goal to spread the gospel and to bring glory to God regardless of what happens to us. Lastly, he instructs Timothy to set an example to the believers in purity. The word used here was hagani, which actually refers specifically to sexual sin. But it's a very broad term. It's not just like physical act. This would actually incorporate everything associated with his relationship with a person of the opposite sex. This word accompanied a total view and outlook on his relationship to women. So he is not just saying keep yourself pure. He is saying keep every single aspect of your relationships with every single woman correct and pure. Can you imagine the stir that would cause in Ephesus? knowing what we know about the city and just the insidious, horrific, lust-centered everything that there was, to have somebody that just didn't, that believed with such unbelievable conviction in the God that he worshiped, that he would not, regardless of the temptation, regardless of the opportunities, it would not happen, because he loved and he trusted his Savior that much. How different would that look? It looks different here. Can you imagine what it looked like there? It should not come as a surprise to us at all. What Paul knew about that day and age is still true about this day and age. 1 Timothy 3:2, it runs down the qualifications for somebody in ministry. And the quickest way to get yourself disqualified is an immorality in this area. So, of course, this is one of the enemy's primary avenues for attack. Because he knows if you are caught in this sin, it is over. It is an instant disqualification. And Paul needed to get this through to Timothy because he knew what was coming. He knew what that culture was. He knew the attacks that would come when that revival began to grow and the church became to prosper. We should read these commands with urgency, with application to our own lives, with a deep understanding that, as important as it was to Timothy then, it is important to us now to be able to set an example in speech and in conduct and in faith and in love and in purity, because without those, we have no hope to reach a world that is just waiting for us to mess up. And here is Timothy, placed in the most horrific, terrible city, filled with the most disgusting of sin that you can possibly imagine, and he stood like a stone, and he was an example. He was an example of speech and of conduct and of faith and of love and of purity. And for 45 years, he ministered in Ephesus, and I can't even imagine what that would mean. I can't imagine being in a city that every year, at the beginning of April, there was a festival of a parade of that kind, and I had to instruct my sheep to batten down the hatches and keep track of your sons and your daughters, because there's millions of people that are to come, and it's going to be terrible and it's going to be horrible. I can't imagine living in a society that dark, trying to care for people surrounded by that much horror. In 97 AD, Timothy had enough. Church history records this very clearly and beautifully. At the age of 80 years old, in the middle of the festival of rejuvenation for the goddess of Artemis, when they would take that statue down and they would march it down the streets and they would smear it with their own blood, and the most horrific acts would be happening all over the place, Timothy said, "I've had enough. I don't want to tell them to batten down the hatches anymore. I don't want to have to guard their sons and their daughters anymore. I can't do it. I can't deal with it. I'm done." And he went out into the street and he tried to stop that procession. And he put himself in harm's way in the middle of a horrific blood and lust festival. And he was beaten. And he was dragged through the streets behind that statue. And when they got to the edge of the river, they stoned him, and he was martyred in Ephesus. He overcame. He died a beautiful, beautiful death. He overcame a blood status. He overcame a background that would turn most men useless by being told their whole life that they're disqualified and that they're not good enough. He overcame what was more than likely the most horrific city in the world. And he led a church there that grew and prospered for 45 years. Years. It all started when he was way too young to be there in the first place. I don't know where this message finds you this morning. I don't know what you've been through. I don't know who's called you disqualified. Maybe you've had a rocky background and everybody knows it. Maybe you've done something really, really stupid and everybody knows it. And you feel disqualified and you feel not good enough and you've been told your whole life that that is true. You know what? Maybe you've been to a church that's done the same. Maybe you've been somewhere that set the bar so high that you couldn't help but feel disqualified your whole life. Because when you live under a law instead of living under grace, it is impossible not to feel insufficient. It is impossible not to tell yourself over and over and over again that you are disqualified, or to hear somebody else tell you that you are disqualified because of things that you have done or the things that you have not done or the place or way in which you were born or who you were born to. I would encourage you to consider those that God has always chosen. He has always chosen those that were never good enough. He has always chosen those that thought they could never rise. He has always chosen those that have been told they can never rise. What would happen if we all admitted that we're not good enough? That we never were. That if there was any way of doing so, then the cross would not have happened and that Christ died in vain. And just recognize that we're not good enough, but that God loved us the most, and through him, everything is redeemed. By the blood of Christ, everything is redeemed. Your background, your status, your birth, your sin, everything is redeemed because he loves you. And he loves you because he loves you because he loves you. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we are humbled and horrified to think how much we get in your way. I pray, Lord, that you would give each and every one of us the strength to look at our hearts and our desires and our wills to do business with you this morning. To recognize your love and to recognize your hand in our lives because it has existed. Because you're always calling your children to rise. Amen.